not coming from a human source, from a supernatural, superhuman, or transcendental source. So we know it was revealed first by Krishna to Brahma. Brahma passed it on to Narada. Narada passed it on to Vyas. Vyas passed it on to Sukadeva. So it is coming from Krishna directly. So it is definitely a Purusha. Then the third point, that it must present very clearly and very nicely the real meanings of all the Vedic scriptures, including the four Vedas, Itihasas, Puranas, Upanishads, and everything. So, in this regard, of course, there are many verses, but we could mention 1.1.3, the third verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, famous verse also. Nigama kalpataro galitam palam sukamukad amrita dravya samyutam pibata bhagavatam rasam alayam muhuraho rasaka bhuvi bhavuka. O expert and thoughtful men, relish Srimad Bhagavatam, the mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literatures. It emanated from the lips of Shukadeva Goswami. Therefore, this fruit has become even more tasteful. Although its nectarian juice was already relishable for all, including liberated souls. So as I said, there are many verses, but this is a very nice verse, 1.1.3. The third verse of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. It is the mature fruit of the desire tree of the Vedic literatures. That tree has produced many fruits, but this is the best fruit. The very best fruit, growing right on the top, where it gets the sun all day. If a fruit is on one side, it'll get the sun for certain hours, but then not in other hours. If it's kind of inside the tree, it may not get very much sun at all. But if it's on the top, it'll get the sun all the time. This is Srimad Bhagavatam. Then, the fourth point was that it must be reconcilable in agreement with Vedanta Sutra. Now, Lord Chaitanya took it to be the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. There are verses in Srimad Bhagavatam which basically more or less state that, but the main verse, in fact this is going to come up in, I think it's 22 or 21, there are going to be two whole texts dedicated to just analyzing this one verse from Garuda Purana, which I'll give you now, which is like really clear in many respects, actually. Garuda Purana says, Arto yam Brahma Sutranam Bharatarta Vinirnaya Gayatri Basya Rupo Sau Vedarta Paribrimhita Granto Stadasha Sahasra Srimad Bhagavata Bida. So, this is a very important verse. And the meaning is, the Srimad Bhagavatam is the authorized explanation of Vedanta Sutra. And it is a further explanation of Mahabharat. It is the expansion of the Gayatri Mantra. And the essence of all Vedic knowledge. This Srimad Bhagavatam, containing 18,000 verses, is known as the explanation of all Vedic knowledge. And it goes on to say, it is spoken directly by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's pretty clear. It is the authorized explanation. And even just having said that, we know that Vyas and Narada met. Vyas was feeling frustrated even though he had presented Vedanta Sutra. So Narada told him, no, you've got to present Srimad Bhagavatam. Or you've got to present Krishna. You've got to present Krishna very clearly. So, and then in terms of its availability, which is the fifth point, then Garuda Purana, we just read, it says it's got 18,000 verses. Srimad Bhagavatam itself says it's got 18,000 verses. There are a few other Puranas which say it has 18,000 verses. And it happens to have 18,000 verses, if you count them, I mean, or thereabouts. Yeah. So it is available in its entirety today. So in this way, Srimad Bhagavatam fulfills these ultimate requirements for being that best source of knowledge. It's a sattvic Purana, it's a Purusheya, it has the complete meaning of all the Vedic literatures, it explains Vedanta Sutra very nicely, and it's completely available. So there we have it. Srimad Bhagavatam is the topmost pramana. Mm-hmm. It's included. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Brahma Sutra and Vedanta Sutra. Two names for the same book. Yeah. Just try and carry on, because we're kind of a little bit behind slightly. Let us go on to the next, it's the next complete section, actually. We have now established, basically, that Srimad Bhagavatam is the praman that we're going to use for defining the absolute truth, understanding the absolute truth, and in this way, developing proper knowledge and perfecting our lives. So from verse 19, text 19 to text 26, Jiva Goswami first of all identifies what is that book called Srimad Bhagavatam. We don't want to get confused with some other book. Again, like this whole thing, this whole exercise we've just been through, I assume that we all, before we came into this seminar, we had all basically come to the conclusion that Srimad Bhagavatam was the best scripture. And when we had to go through this whole procedure, as we've just done, we might feel that, well, we didn't really need to do that. But anyway, I think it was actually quite important, and very interesting at least, and in certain preaching situations, it'll be very valuable for you. Now, here, he's going to identify which book we mean when we say, oh, Srimad Bhagavatam. Again, we might say, well, we know what is Srimad Bhagavatam. We're not going to get confused and think some other book is Srimad Bhagavatam. However, unfortunately, there are some people who are confused like that. Even today, but in the time of Jiva Goswami, they were quite a big movement. Just like these people who don't recognize the Puranas were quite a big movement. So there was another movement also of people who thought that when different scriptures refer to this very wonderful book called the Bhagavat, that they're referring to a book called the Devi Bhagavat and not Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, probably many of you will never have heard of Devi Bhagavat. So, but it was a problem for Jiva Goswami dealing with these people. So therefore, he is now, first of all, in verses 19 and 20, he is going to pretty much define what book we are referring to when we say Srimad Bhagavatam or the Bhagavat Purana. Let us read through text 19. 19.1. After bringing all the Puranas to light and compiling the Vedanta Sutra, the powerful sage Vyas was still not satisfied. Therefore, he then manifested as a product of mature meditation this Bhagavatam, the natural commentary on his own sutras. That's what Lord Chaitanya said, that Srimad Bhagavatam is the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra by the author of Vedanta Sutra. So he didn't feel it necessary for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas to write their own commentary on Vedanta Sutra, which was normally done by the Sampradayas. In fact, it was generally felt that they had to do it to be recognized as a Sampradaya. And eventually, Baladev Vijayabhushan did write a commentary, but only because of sort of political pressure, kind of. Not because it was really felt to be theologically a necessity. Theologically, the Bhagavatam is the natural commentary already by the same author himself who wrote Vedanta Sutra. So the coherent overview of all scriptures is found in this work, Srimad Bhagavatam, inasmuch as it begins under the auspices of the Gayatri Mantra. Shoo, we're going to now get into a rather amazing area for some of you, analyzing the Gayatri Mantra. Understanding, you could say, the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam as being an explanation of the Brahma Gayatri, the popular Gayatri. We've written up here some words from that. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. Inasmuch as it begins under the auspices of the Gayatri Mantra, which is distinguished as the foundational text for the purport of all the Vedas. This Gayatri Mantra, you know what I'm referring to? Anyone not to know what mantra I'm referring to? It's this one here. We left out a few words because you're not meant to write out the whole thing. Yeah? So it is a very important and very Vedic text. It is a verse from the Rig Veda. And it is accepted, that Gayatri is accepted as the foundational text for the purport of all the Vedas. 19.2. In just this manner, the Matsya Purana depicts the identity of Srimad Bhagavatam as follows. So now he is identifying. In the beginning of one of the Puranas, the Gayatri Mantra is the focus of discourse. In it, all the ramifications of true religion are delineated, and the killing of the demon Vritra is described. The Purana which has these characteristics is known as Srimad Bhagavatam. A person who transcribes a copy of the Bhagavatam places it on a gold lion throne, Singhasan, and gives this as a gift to someone on the full moon day of the month, Proshtapada, will achieve the supreme goal of life. This Purana is said to have 18,000 verses. So, well, that fits the description of Srimad Bhagavatam, 18,000 verses. And, well, as we're going to discuss, it is based on Gayatri, right at the very beginning. And the killing of Vritrasura is described there. And 19.3. The word Gayatri here indicates the basic meaning of Gayatri, along with the one word Dhimahi, which alludes to the Gayatri texts and invariably occurs within them. It would be improper to utter in this context the actual Gayatri, the primeval form of all Vedic mantras. The meaning of Gayatri is found in the phrases. Now he's referring to Srimad Bhagavatam 111. And if you look in 19.3 in the Sanskrit in the third line, you'll see the actual words there. Janmadyasya yataha and tene brahma rida, which mean So this meaning of the Gayatri is found in these phrases: from whom proceeds the generation, maintenance, and destruction of this universe, and he imparted the transcendental sound of the Vedas from within the heart. So they're part of 111. These two phrases express ideas identical to ideas contained in Gayatri, that the supreme truth is the shelter of all the worlds, and that he is the inspirer of intelligence. In the phrase, all the ramifications of religion, the word religion or dharma means the supreme religion, since Bhagavatam, as we just mentioned actually, 112, says, in this work, the supreme religion is described, to the exclusion of all kinds of cheating religion. Dharma projita kaitavo tra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. No kaitava dharma, no material religion which is understood to all be cheating religion, ultimately. Such activities as meditation on the personality of Godhead are the specific features of the supreme religion, as we will make evident later on. Well, we ran out of time, I'm afraid, but tomorrow we can talk a bit about Gayatri and its relationship with Srimad Bhagavatam, and particularly the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. But you could read on over 20, 21, 22. Why don't you read over 20, 21, 22? We'll try and cover them tomorrow if we can. But one of the important points which is drawn out through all these verses is how Srimad Bhagavatam begins with an explanation of this Gayatri. And what is this Gayatri? It is the fundamental verse of the Vedas. It expresses the purport of the Vedas perfectly. And what is Srimad Bhagavatam? Srimad Bhagavatam is, in one sense, nothing more than an expansion of 111. That's all. 111 is like the basic statement of subject. This is what our book is about. And the rest of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam is explaining that. So, you know, among other things, the import of that is that famous Gayatri mantra is not a meditation on the sun, or the sun god even, but a meditation on the absolute truth in a very complete sense. The reason being that, as we've written here, you see, we put the translation there, we're meant to meditate upon the divine sun, the worshipable effulgence of the sun. So, would that mean the sun, our sun? You know, the effulgence is worshipable. Just like here in sort of early May or mid-May or something like that. Then you really get the effulgence of the sun, don't you? Gets up to something like 50 degrees or something, I've heard. So, do you feel like worshipping the sun then? No, you feel like running from the sun then. So even though sometimes the sun may inspire us and enliven us, sometimes the sun may kill us, actually. Yeah, sometimes the sun may kill you. So, the sun as such, to apply these concepts of its effulgence being divine, and that it inspires our meditation, it's not always appropriate to apply this to the sun. Sometimes it may be, but many times it may not be appropriate. So the idea is that actually that Gayatri mantra is telling us to meditate on Krishna. And to make it even more complete, in Krishna Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami explains, he gives an explanation of Srimad Bhagavatam 111 as being a description of Radha and Krishna and their relationship. So seeing that 111 is an explanation of the Gayatri, it means that the Gayatri is ultimately telling us to meditate on Radha and Krishna. So, anyway, we'll explain that as we go. Any final questions or comments? All right. Try and read 20, 21, and 22. We'll do our best to get through them tomorrow if we can. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Was, you know, if Yoga Maya just took Krishna, even took him to the side and said, look, you know, these ladies are not really married to anyone. Actually, they're your own internal pleasure potency. So for you to relate with them is fine. It's not at all immoral. In fact, it's even more moral, in a sense, than having your own wife, because they're actually parts of you. They're not even separate persons, really. And then Krishna wouldn't have to be in anxiety about the husbands, and so on and so forth. But the pastimes wouldn't be so much fun. So therefore we have this principle of vibrama vilas, joyous pastimes through the medium of seeming error. And this is just what makes, it's one of the main elements which makes these pastimes and everything just so wonderful. So extremely wonderful. And it's the thrill of apparently breaching this moral position that these girls are married to other men. The thrill of apparently breaching this code of conduct, which makes the Parakya Rasa the most desirable for Krishna. He enjoys it the most. You know, Mother Yashoda is his mother. It's pretty straightforward. You know, relationship with the mother, it's kind of straightforward in a certain way. There's no, like, really thrilling twist on it. It's just mother and son. And with the friends also, you know, there's no special twist on it. It's just their friends. But with the gopis, there's this special twist that they're married, supposedly. And the special twist and the, you know, the excitement and the drama of having to deal with this and meet under all this apparent pressure. Oh, it makes it so exhilarating. It's, you know, it's like what they call a cliffhanger or something like that. Some very extraordinary, dramatic presentation, you know, in which the hero is going from one desperate situation to another. And if he just walked straight through everything and nothing ever went wrong and it just all worked out without any difficulty, then why would people be interested in the story? But because it's so dramatic at every step, something unusual is happening and Krishna's having to resort to all sorts of tactics. And it's just so extraordinarily exciting. Krishna finds it so wonderful. And the principle is breaching this moral standard. It's just such a thing. And in this way, the exhilaration increases. So there's, let's see. If we look on, it's I think page 68, there's an explanation given. Let's see, where is it? is it? 68. Oh yeah, page 68, it's about halfway down, just beneath halfway. In the visible pastimes, I mean, we should really read the whole purport, but we haven't got time, I'm afraid. In the visible pastimes on the mundane plane, the function in the form of the nuptial relationship, the married relationship, is found to exist. But Krishna is beyond the scope of that function. Hence, the said function of this married relationship is contrived by yoga maya. Krishna tastes the transcendental rasa akin to paramourship by overstepping that function, the function of being married. This pastime of going beyond the pale, beyond the boundaries, beyond the pale basically means beyond the boundaries of the apparent moral function of the gopis being married, which is manifested by yoga maya, is however also observable only on the mundane plane. Anyway, people on the mundane plane look on it as being immoral, that's the idea. But there is really no such levity or like immorality. Levity basically means lack of, you know, like properness in the pastimes of Krishna. So this is really what makes it so much fun. The error is that apparently the gopis are married. And if Krishna starts getting involved with married women, that is an error. If someone gets involved with someone married, that is an error. Actually, it's not an error, as we explained. Because the marriage is really with the material bodies of the gopis. Whereas they, in their actual positions, because they're like their nitya siddhas, or sadhana siddhas, they're perfect souls in pure spiritual bodies. That's who they really are. But for the sake of the husbands, they manifest second forms. In their actual forms, they're eternally related with Krishna, either as part of his internal potency or just on the basis of being the eternal servants of Krishna by constitution. But there's this seeming error that seemingly they're married. Even I was reading, I think it was Jiva Goswami was saying in Krishna Sandarbha, that there are some husbands like Abhimanyu who object to Krishna. They really object. But according to Jiva Goswami, there are others who don't. And because they're very elevated devotees, and they think, well, you know, she, the wife, is sort of meant to be my wife, but actually, I know that everything belongs to Krishna, including her. So if Krishna wants to enjoy with her, well, that's perfect. So there's a certain group of husbands who feel quite happy with it, one way or the other. In which ones? The ones who get into anxiety. Oh, all of them? Well, I don't know, really. The question is, what is the relationship or relationships of the husbands with Krishna? Well, to tell you the truth, I haven't come across, you know, a clear definition of that. But those who Jiva Goswami mentions as not being envious, you know, transcendentally or otherwise, of Krishna relating with their wives, they would have some sort of friendly relationship or something like that, one would imagine, or perhaps of servitorship. Not parental, because then the wife would be too old, but some sort of relationship like that. But the other ones, like Abhimanyu, well, that I haven't seen any description of. It's an interesting question. A friend of Kamsa. I see. Okay. Read out of the purport just a little point about the element of the seeming error and how it contributes and how it is like the special element which elevates this whole rasa to its own unique platform above all the other rasas. The next rasa beneath this is Swakya as such, when Krishna's in Dwaraka, when Krishna's in Vaikuntha. Then there is actual Swakya rasa, and he has his wives, and there's that formal tie, and that lack of excitement, because he's the husband, and you know they know they have to serve him, and he knows he has to also reciprocate, but that excitement is not there. The question is, what is the location of Dwaraka and Mathura in the overall context of the spiritual realm? So Goloka has three main divisions: Gokula or Vrindavan, Mathura and Dwaraka. Dwaraka is not in the Vaikuntha realm as such, meaning it's not one of the Vaikuntha planets. But the question is, what is the position of Mathura? What are the opulences of Mathura? And what's the position and opulences of Dwaraka? Well, in Mathura, the mood of spontaneous love, which completely and only dominates in Vrindavan, is also apparent quite prominently in Mathura, fairly prominently, although there's a certain amount of awe and reverence. In Dwaraka, then the mood of spontaneity, in other words, forgetting Krishna as God and just getting absorbed in the relationship, he's my friend, like that, or he's my husband, or then that spontaneous mood is also existing, but it's even less. Swakya, yes, but just because the devotees in whose natural abode is Dwaraka, their love for Krishna is less than in Vrindavan. In Vaikuntha, there is no yoga maya in that sense. Everyone is completely clear all the time that Lord Narayan is definitely God, and they never forget that. But in Dwaraka, they forget it sometimes. In Mathura, they forget it, you know, more frequently at least. And in Vrindavan, they practically never seriously think that Krishna's God. It sometimes occurs to them, momentarily. Yeah. But the ecstasy of the relationship, the rasa as such, as friend or parent or lover, like that, that ecstasy is just sweeping away their consciousness always. The gopis, some of them are expansions of Srimati Radharani, that's a fact. Some of them, not all, by any means. Some, there are different groups of cowherd boys. Some of them are manifestations of the internal potency, like Sridham, Subal, and various others. They are manifestations. They're not jivas. They're actually part of Krishna's internal potency. Others are perfect jivas who happen to have that rasa with Krishna. Yeah, and the gopis, they're manifestations of the internal potency, some of them, and others are perfect jivas. And the parents, Nanda and Yashoda, they're not jivas. They're not living entities like us. They're manifestations of the internal potency. They're manifested by the chit shakti, the internal potency. But then others who are in the parental rasa, they are perfect jivas. Is that okay? Let's just carry on a bit here. Oh, we were going to read something. Just one more, I think. Yeah, one more little excerpt in which Srila Bhaktisiddhanta talks about how the rasa is excited, the experience is excited, and everything is increased because of this twist of this apparent error of going against the moral principle of marriage. So this is on page 69, and it's more or less halfway down the page. By the sentiments of ownership, do you see that? By the sentiments of ownership, there cannot be the extreme inaccessibility of the rasa. So the gopis have naturally, from eternity, the innate sentiment of being others' wedded wives. Krishna, too, in response to that sentiment, by assuming the reciprocal sentiment of paramourship, they feel they have husbands. He reciprocates by acting as if they do. And, you know, that whole thing of avoiding the husband and wheeling and dealing in different ways. So he performs the rasa dance, I guess, and the other amorous pastimes with the aid of the flute, his favorite, cher ami, which for those of you who don't know French means dear friend. Goloka is the transcendental seat of eternally self-realized rasa, beyond limited conception. Hence in Goloka, there's realization of the sentimental assumption of the rasa of paramourship. That last little statement we did mention yesterday. There's a realization of the sentimental assumption. Just within their minds, just on the emotional level, they're assuming that there is paramourship. But there isn't. In Goloka, there are no husbands anyway. They don't even exist. It's just this sentiment, wow, my husband. And then someone sent by Yoga Maya comes and says, oh, your husband is coming. So that's Yoga Maya. There is no husband to come. But someone comes along and warns them like that. And in this material realm here, in Vrindavan, within this world, then there is a husband. But we've talked about that already. There's no connection. Generally, there's no connection of any sort. And it's just like, it's sort of like a living hallucination, actually, the relationship with the husband. There's no substance to it. And then he goes on to explain the same thing about birth. In Goloka, there is no birth, but there's this sentimental assumption. There's this emotional feeling and this idea in the mind. In the minds of Nanda and Yashoda, that Krishna is our son. He took birth from us and he's our son, and therefore we're his parents. And there's very amazing in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Akrura takes Krishna to Mathura, when he arrives and he's sort of negotiating to get them to let him to take Krishna, and it's really very very difficult. The whole thing's very difficult. He's having to argue in different ways. In the end, Akrura breaks down. He just breaks down because he's in his Mathura mood, and he says, look, you have to let Krishna come. Otherwise, Kamsa's going to kill his parents, Vasudeva and Devaki. As far as Akrura is concerned, they're Krishna's parents. And then various other members of the Yadu dynasty who are related to Vasudeva and Devaki, apparently Kamsa wants to kill them too, and the only one who can help is Krishna. And Akrura knows this. So Akrura is pleading, please, you have to save the lives of these people. It's not right that they be killed by Kamsa. You have to allow Krishna to come. He's begging the inhabitants of Vrindavan to release Krishna and saying that his poor parents, Kamsa is going to kill them any day. So he's just completely in anxiety. And then the gopis reply, and it's very, very amazing reply. They say, who are the parents of the son of Nanda and Yashoda? Who are these people? So you have this clash, and they're very serious also. Who are these people you say are the parents of the son of Nanda and Yashoda? Anyway, Akrura eventually takes Krishna. Yeah. So this is, everything is getting excited. Everything, you know, the whole mood, all the different moods are getting aroused by these errors. Krishna's nobody's child. Actually, everyone is Krishna's child in one sense. But here we have these seeming errors, and now there's apparently two. He's the son of Vasudeva and Devaki and Nanda and Yashoda. And what is the end result of that? Extreme increase of transcendental rasa. All these different ecstasies and bhavas and different feelings and moods are mixing with each other. And the end result which comes out is just like an explosion, an ongoing explosion of ecstasy, of different ecstasies in Krishna's relationships with his devotees. And it's all vibrama vilas, joyous pastimes through the medium of seeming error. Anyway, there's an error as far as the parenthood goes. But normally in the parenthood, parental relationship, there isn't. It's just sort of by the way that Krishna is not really their child. Then on to text 38. How the devotee realizes the rasa. We mentioned this a little bit yesterday, that Lord Brahma says that the pure devotees, when someone comes to that level, pure devotional service or prema, when they actually become God realized as such, then they see in their heart of hearts, with the eye of devotion tinged with the salve of love. And in the purport we pointed out, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta made the point in the middle of the purport on page 75, that the devotees, he says nowadays, he's referring to like, well, this is Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, so he's referring to maybe 60 or 70 years ago, I suppose. Nowadays also, the devotees see him in Vraja in their hearts. Anyway, those devotees who are qualified, I'm sure they do. Saturated with devotion, although they do not see him with their eyes. The eye of devotion is nothing but the eye of the pure, unalloyed, spiritual self of the jiva. And the form of Krishna is visible to that eye in proportion to its purification by the practice of devotion. So there's the whole process. Ado shraddha tatha sadhu sangha, and up to prema. And then there are different levels of prema even. So when the devotee premanjana charita bhakti valochanena, when the devotee's eye is anointed with the salve or ointment of love, prema, this means prema. In fact, the very word prema is used. So when love is there, then this vision is there. We're on text 38 for the benefit of any of those who got left behind. Text 38. Ointment. Yes, medicinal sort of commodity of some sort. But Prabhupada talks about it as an ointment. Salve means actually an ointment. It's like a sort of thick type of substance. So prema has to be there. There's a very nice description, I'm sure many of you have read it, in Madhurya Kadambini, about the devotees going from Shraddha to prema. So in the description about asakti, which is the third to last level, bhava, there's prema is the topmost, then bhava, then asakti. Asakti means intense attachment to Krishna. So on that level, according to Bhakti, sometimes sort of thinks that he just caught a glimpse of Krishna. And then looks and says, no. So the description is there that he goes up, he sees some boy and asks him, have you seen Nandanandan today? Or he's thinking that this boy can help me find Krishna. There's this idea that Krishna's around, but where, you know, is he there? No, he's not there. But, oh, wait, no, he's not there. It's just like little hints. But on the level of bhava, the devotee actually starts to perceive Krishna sometimes. And as a result, this intense attraction, already intense attraction, increases further. And then on the level of prema, as this verse is saying, then they see Krishna in their heart of hearts with their pure spiritual eyes of their spiritual bodies. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the way he explains that, it's very sort of quite dramatic. That first of all, I forget the order, but first of all they may see Krishna. Then when they see Krishna, all their, because the sight, the vision of Krishna is so overwhelming, and because now they have spiritual bodies. And same as with Krishna's spiritual body. Krishna can see with his hands, impregnate with his eyes, and eat with his feet. So they can also do the same thing. They can also do the same thing on a minute level. Krishna can impregnate all the living entities with one glance. So the living entities in their pure state, they have these sort of interchangeable functions of their senses. So when they see Krishna, then all the senses assume the potency of sight. So they're seeing Krishna with their ears and tongues and skin and their noses. They're just seeing Krishna totally. And then he plays the flute and they hear the flute. Then all their senses become ears. So they're just getting this, you know, we can't imagine, just incredible absorption and overwhelming experience of perception of Krishna. Then they smell Krishna. And then they're smelling him through their ears and eyes and toes and very amazing. So these are just different features of Krishna one by one. First of all, to see, then to hear, then to smell, then to touch. But then suddenly he reveals all of them simultaneously, that you can see and hear and touch and smell and taste even Krishna simultaneously. And then all the senses are just, it must be quite, it is very overwhelming. And then the devotee, when the devotee comes to that level, suddenly the devotee realizes, I don't have a material body any longer. And it's not like, you know, you leave your body and it's a big test, a big strain. But he notices, oh, I don't have a material body any longer. He's left his material body behind and he's actually with Krishna. So anyway, this is what is going on here, that those devotees who are on that extremely high level of pure devotional service, they can actually see Krishna, but with their internal eye, the spiritual body is manifest. And Srila Prabhupada talks about this. He gives the example of a coconut. You may have heard the example before. That a coconut, initially, when it's green, it's more or less like one entity. But as it ripens and then goes brown and like that, then the flesh within hardens and separates from the shell. So after a while, you can shake it and you'll hear this rattling, that there's a second thing within which is separate from the external shell. So in a similar way, Prabhupada explains that a devotee who comes to the level of prema and enters into his or her eternal relationship with Krishna, that the spiritual body manifests, and then they're now living on two levels simultaneously. On one level, they're living as a devotee, as we know devotees, living in terms of the external body. On another level, they're with Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. They're seeing him, talking to him, touching him, relating with him in terms of their rasa, but that's all internal in their spiritual forms. So similarly, with his spiritual eyes, the eyes of his spiritual body, such an exalted devotee is seeing Krishna within the heart of hearts, right in the innermost part of his or her being. Yeah. The question is, does this mean that such a devotee is literally living and acting simultaneously on two levels? Yes. Sometimes, of course, the two merge. The devotee goes into a trance and, you know, like a state of samadhi, something like that, and just becomes absorbed internally and stops functioning externally. But otherwise, yes, they're living on both levels simultaneously. Externally, yes, an excellent regular devotee, but internally, they're never not with Krishna. How would they give that up? How could they give that up? They're always with Krishna. But externally, they're conducting themselves in a way which is acceptable externally. Of course, sometimes they get so absorbed internally that externally, then they tend to become like avadutas. Externally, they just become, you know, they kind of lose contact with the external reality. Yeah. Like Vamsidas Babaji, I'm sure you've heard about him. There's that one story that one very formal Sri Sampradaya sannyasi came to discuss with Vamsidas Babaji about something to do with Krishna conscious philosophy. And he saw the deities that Vamsidas Babaji had, and they were very informal, Gornatai, but not looked after well externally, and Ladu Gopal, and I forget who, but some deities like that. And the sannyasi was not familiar with Ladu Gopal or Gornatai. So he asked, he pointed to Ladu Gopal, said, "Who is that?" Vamsidas Babaji said, "Oh, him? He's a thief." "Oh, I see." So then the sannyasi pointed to Gornatai, said, "And who are they?" Vamsidas Babaji said, "Oh, them. They're the leaders of a gang of thieves." And another time, supposedly, Vamsidas Babaji was sitting talking to one devotee, but then his attention became drawn to the deities, and he was just looking at the deities, and just like transfixed on them for a moment. Then he turned to the devotee and said, "Did you hear what Gauranga just told me?" And the devotee said, "Well, no, I didn't actually." And Vamsidas Babaji said, "That Gauranga told me, Vamsidas, you're getting too old to go out and beg now. You stay here, and I'll go and beg food for you." Then Vamsidas was a little perplexed. Didn't really know what to do or say. Then he suddenly picked up a stick, and he shouted at the deities, at Lord Chaitanya, "You try to serve me? I'll break your legs." So, you know, when, in fact, you'll, perhaps if you're doing this course of Giriraj Maharaj's, it may be part of it. Anyway, it's in the nature of devotion, that one of the characteristics of a devotee on the level of prema, there's just a small number of characteristics, like 3 or 4 or 5 or something, like major characteristics. And one of them is, can't be understood. Yeah. Because, you know, how could they not be absorbed? Having entered into that state eternally, how could they not be absorbed? But they may tend to get so absorbed that they just lose interest in the external reality. Unless, of course, you know, if like in the case of someone like Srila Prabhupada, and Jiva Goswami talks about this also, that even such an elevated devotee, if he's ordered by his spiritual master to preach, then he'll maintain that external standard, like impeccably, like such a regulated devotee you've never seen in your life. So strict, how could they be so strict? You can't imagine. But it's on the order of the spiritual master, even though internally they're also absorbed. And, yeah, I mean, they're really absorbed on the most exalted level of contact with Krishna. Well, we were going to go on to 39, 40, 41, and 42, and that's what I wrote these things up on the board for, but we ran out of time. Anyway, that's okay. So we'll go on to all of that tomorrow. Any final comments or questions? Okay, yes, Swamiji. Drona and Dara are like shadow representations or partial expansions within the demigods, within the society of demigods. Actually, there are two understandings that I've seen about Drona and Dara. One is, just like in the case of Uddhava, if you recall, he was one of the 8 Vasus, allowed to live in the same body as Uddhava, as a partial expansion of Uddhava. Do you remember that? I mean, this may sound a little sort of far out, but Uddhava took part in Krishna's pastimes here in the form of a partial expansion of Uddhava. Occupying the same body was one of the 8 Vasus who had become perfect in his previous life, to like learn the mode of devotional service of Uddhava. So Drona and Dara, who were perfect demigods, were allowed to enter the bodies of Nanda and Yashoda to learn the parental relationship. That's one explanation. Another explanation, and I think it's like more common, is that Nanda and Yashoda expand. Amongst the demigods, they expand as Drona and Dara. So Drona and Dara, they're like partial expansions of Nanda and Yashoda. And they're always, when the Lord is appearing, always or regularly, they're taking the roles of being his parents, particularly when he's appearing amongst the demigods. Something like that. Kasyapa and Aditi. I forget exactly. There's a description of Kasyapa and Aditi in terms of being connected with Drona and Dara, if I remember correctly. Anyway, the description about Kasyapa and Aditi is that they, in their next lives, became... There were the three births, right, leading up to two births leading up to Vasudeva and Devaki. Sutapa and Prishni, and then Kasyapa and Aditi, or Kasyapa and Aditi were first, I think.